Blog Talk Radio. Thanks for listening to Eastern Airlines Radio. My name is Neil Holland, the producer of the show, and we have a great show for you tonight. I'm going to ask Chuck Albright to stand in for Jim Hart, our regular announcer tonight, but Chuck is down in the villages in the middle of Florida. Chuck, how are you?
Cool weather that the snowbirds brought down with us is cooling us off enough to get out there on the golf courses and have a nice day. I'm taking Jim Hart's place, as you know, and the Villages is about 70 miles north of Orlando. Along with our other hosts at different locations, we want to welcome and thank you for listening and calling the show. You have truly made us the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We love to hear your comments and share your memories with the radio listeners from around the world during the broadcast. If you haven't called the show before, all you need to do is call 213-816-1611 and just say hello to talk with us on the air live. We can identify many countries around the world who listen in with their Blog Talk Radio application. Isn't it great that we can keep the Eastern legacy going out, not only to the Eastern family, but to the Eastern listeners from all different countries around the world? That's what we try to do every week on the EAL radio show. Want to join us by adding your voice to the broadcast? So, thank you also to those who choose to listen to by on computer using the radio icon on your homepage at www.EALRadioshow.com, or perhaps by signing in at the site of our provider, Blog Talk Radio, at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Should you wish to talk during our live broadcast, feel free to use our call-in number, 213-816-1611, at 7 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Let me repeat the number so you can write it down for your Monday night visits. 213-816-1611. And by the way, tell your friends about us. And don't forget, you can listen to any of our 391 Monday night broadcasts and 75-plus Thursday broadcasts by simply going to blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. Scrolling down through the archives of our broadcast, each episode is briefly described. Our lines are always open for calls, and if you choose not to participate with the live talk with our host, we'd ask you to please mute your phone, as your producer does not have the capability of filtering out all the background noises, kind of like ice and glasses type things. Let me ask our host to check in with their names, where they're calling from, and what the weather is in the backyard or their backyards today.
Well, Chuck, I'm going to take the microphone here and say we've got so many hosts. We have one special guest host, and actually two, and we're going to identify our host in just a minute. But thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's not our usual day, and it's our time slot, but not the normal day. We are doing this on Sunday, and golly, Pete, my board is completely lit up, so we'll have a real good discussion, I believe, tonight. But I can see we've got folks from New York, the Long Island Sound, and we've got them out in Oregon and Seattle, Washington, so lots of folks, and we'll be listening to them as we go into our show. So I'm going to take off flight 392. And here we go, blasting off. Tonight?
I am with you. Thank you, Neil. Our guest host tonight is Christine Negroni, and we have a round table as well that's with Christine. I'm sorry, I didn't hear, I thought someone was talking. Excuse me. Christine Negroni is one of our former hosts. She's been on as our guest here and there. Several different times, and we're so happy to have her. Christine, would you say hello?
Hello. Thank you so much, Dorothy, Neil, Chuck, George, all of you, Carlene, for inviting me to be on. It's always fun to talk to you. I love hearing that Eastern song at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, we kind of love it, too. Neil?
Christine, you've written a book that deals with this type of show that we're having tonight. Could you tell us what it's about and how a person can? Let's start off with a little ad here from you, Christine.
Please, that's so nice of you. How did you know I would love to talk about my book? My book is called The Crash Detective, and it's a Wall Street Journal must-read. George Jenn features prominently in one section of the book, but it talks. The Crash Detectives is the story of a number of aviation mysteries, beginning with the disappearance of Malaysia 370, but it also talks about some airline accidents that have been attributed to one or two factors when there might have been other contributing factors that were left hushed up. So there's a bit of a section on conspiracies. There's a great deal of discussion in my book about the fallibility of the human and the interaction of the human and the machine, and how that sometimes can create the human, the machine, and the computer, and how that can sometimes create misunderstandings among those three components, which lead to accidents. That I think is very much going to be a factor in what we talk about tonight. But finally, and I always say this when I give book talks, that people think that I'm a bit of a disaster queen because this is my second book on aviation disasters, and I'm not at all a disaster queen. In fact, I think that my book is very uplifting because it talks about how airline accidents over the years have taught us so much, and it is through these accidents that we learn how to fly safer, how to be better pilots, better mechanics, better airlines, have better air systems, better airplane design, and that's what allows us to get on an airplane every day and never think twice about whether we'll arrive at our destination safely. That's a wonderful story. It's a happy story, and I think that that's the story I tell in The Crash Detective.
Very good. That's going to be a good discussion. I'm going to reach way across the country and introduce two guests that we also have tonight before we really get into our topic tonight, and we have Carlene Petit. I've always wanted to say Petit. I don't know why. Carlene, are you with us tonight?
I am with you, and you're absolutely correct. It's Pettit.
Right. Say hello and what you're doing, Carlene.
Hello, what am I doing right at the moment while I'm talking to you?
No, I want a little bit of advertising out of you. You've written several books, too.
I have. I've written several novels. The most recent is Flight for Sanity. It's a series, a trilogy, basically in the airline industry. Next one that will be coming is called Flight for Justice. However, that has been put on a little bit of hold to finish my dissertation for my PhD, and which I'm actually researching exactly what we're going to be talking tonight about, automation and pilot flight.
Wonderful. And also, we have Jeff Lewis. Jeff, you with us?
Yeah, I am. I sure do appreciate the way you guys put together these shows. They're wanted to participate in, and so many good people.
Thanks for being. Now, you're in Oregon, right?
Yeah, and it just got up to a balmy 41 degrees here this hour.
Okay.
We've been socked in with fog.
That's kind of typical this time of year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And way down in deep Georgia, deep South Georgia, around the campfire, we have Jim Holder. Jim, you with us?
Yeah, but I'm not around the campfire. It's raining. I'm inside my camper right now listening to it.
Okay.
Oh,
good to have you with us. And up in New York, we have George Jen. George, how are you?
I'm doing well, very well tonight, Neil. Thank you.
Any new books, George?
I've just completed another one, but I'm going through the about the 50th rewrite. I'm sure that Carlene and all the other authors on here, including Christine, know what that's all about. So.
And
yes,
right there
do.
In the same. The same area, real close by. Mike Scott. Mike, how are you?
I'm right here, not writing any books. I'm listening in to talk about all this automated stuff here, and always glad to be part of the show.
Okay, very good. Well, and we have Chuck Albright, of course, with us, and I was hoping that we would get Skip Booth with us tonight, but he couldn't make it. He's an aviation attorney, doing nothing but aviation law, and we had him on a couple of weeks ago, and a very interesting show that we had with Skip. So I think we'll talk a little bit about the legal aspects of this tonight also, this crash of Lion Air. So I'm going to start off by asking Christine, would you tell us everything that you know about what's going on with this Flight 610 and any late news and so forth? I'm just going to give the microphone over to you, Christine.
Okay, well, I'm going to try not to ramble on too long, but I can tell you that a lot's happened with this accident, and you'll remember it was, I think, the 29th of October. The flight took off from Jakarta on its way to a smaller island. Please don't ask me to remember or pronounce the name of it, but about straight north across the water, about a two-hour flight, and shortly after takeoff, within 10 minutes, the airplane was in the water. And looking, when you take a look at the FlightAware flight profile of this aircraft, it's pretty clear that the airplane never had a normal moment of flight after it took off. It wallowed on its way up. It finally wound up about 5,000 feet in the air. It was up and down, making these sort of ascents and descents, and then at one point just sort of fell. It gained a great amount of speed and fell into the water, and that was that. So, you know, really early on, because of the FlightAware flight profile and the fact that the pilot had made one communication back to the controller saying that he wanted to return to the airport, there was a lot of, this looks to be, that the pilot encountered a problem and, the plane was not operating correctly. But then, of course, what came to light within, hours was that the previous, on four previous flights, there had been problems with the angle of attack indicator on the aircraft. So, of course, now it looks like there might have been some problem with that. Now, within a day or two, Boeing had sent out a service bulletin to all operators of the 737 MAX, and that's about 200 aircraft and maybe 10 or so operators, including three in the United States, telling them that, you know, the pilots need to know to cut off power to the stabilizer trim, because under certain circumstances the airplane will essentially take over from the pilot and push the nose down if it senses a stall. So it, you know, and they said in the service bulletin that they had discovered this during the Lion Air investigation. So, you know, now of course it's whipped into a much bigger problem. It's not as initially anticipated, that because Indonesia has not the best air safety record and Lion Air even less of a good safety record, the initial speculation, if you want to call it that, was that the pilots must have, you know, been ill-trained, or the mechanics didn't repair the aircraft correctly and blah, 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 and it was all going to just remain an Indonesia story. This, of course, made it a global story. And a pilot, both from Southwest, which is a big operator of the 737 MAX, and American, also a big operator of the MAX, the pilots were pretty upset about this because they were unaware that this system existed on the aircraft, and it would, by Boeing's own disclosure, essentially put this airplane into a nose-down position that even if the pilots tried to pull back on the yoke and get the nose back up, it would be difficult for them physically, and that even if they were able to recover, after 10 seconds, this system, which is called the maneuvering, I'll have to tell you what it's called, MCAS for now, that this MCAS system would kick in again in 10 seconds. So essentially, you're going to have to turn off the stabilizer trim, and, you know, and Boeing wanted pilots to be aware of it right away. But so that's the story in a nutshell, I guess the coda being that the first lawsuit was filed, I think, on Friday, might have been Wednesday, of last week, and filed in the United States, naming Boeing. So the two poles here are bad airline, bad pilot training, maybe bad pilots, bad mechanics. You know, the blame game goes on. But, you know, Boeing is clearly in the hot seat with this acknowledgement that they put this system on the aircraft, never notified the pilots or the airlines, the operators of it, and have not yet made clear what about the MAX, this new version of their most popular aircraft, what about the MAX required the installation of this system. So it's called the Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, MCAS. And with that, I'll sort of leave it for, you know, those of you who fly airplanes to, you know, to get into the nitty-gritty. I'm just giving you the overview.
Well, Christine, thank you so much. And I'm going to go around the round table and try to take some kind of control. And so we won't be stepping on each other tonight. So I'm going to, again, go out to the West Coast and ask Carlene, what's your thoughts about Flight 610? Carlene?
Hi, Neil. Well, here's the thing. I am of the contention, and my research I've been conducting is based on automation, pilot's manual, flight, level of understanding, and pilot training. And the bottom line is, with automation, our pilots need to know how to fly because equipment's going to break. And we always assume something will break because it gets older. But we've all opened up a package of a computer that didn't work right out of the box. And so things are going to come out that don't work. And human error is going to occur. And that can mean on the ground base also. And so if we take that into account, human error will occur. Maybe they just missed putting it in the manual. The bottom line is, the underlying support system is the pilots need to know how to fly. And we need to know, disengage whatever's not working and fly our airplane. And I find it quite strikingly noticeable that the flight voice recorder has not been located. And I think that would tell us a lot more information if we had that. But the pilot should have been able to disengage that stabilizer, fly that airplane regardless of knowledge of if it was in the book or not.
You know, just a comment here from the Boeing 727 days and the early Boeings, when we had a runaway stabilizer fore and aft, we could use the yoke as a braking mechanism until we got to the circuit breakers or the switches to completely take it offline. And I think George and Mike and Jim Holder, you remember those days when we had that in the Boeing 727. It was a simple system. And I don't know whether this is more I guess it's more complicated. But your thoughts about that? I'm going to ask Jim Holder to come in now.
Well, I've been retired 21 years. FAA made me go at 60, and I'm about as old school as they get. But I do remember in the Air Force, in Mosul at Eastern Airlines, as a new guy, they told us, you're the last thing standing between disaster. And when all else fails, you know, you gotta save it. And to save it, you got to be able to fly it, whether you're on two engines or one engine, or the flap won't come up, the gear won't go down, whatever it is, you got to save it. And the way these planes are made now, maybe I'm still too old school, but I think there ought to be one button somewhere underneath that pilot's left thumb where he can put it back into what it was in the 60s and 70s and 80s, where everything's turned off. All these computers and all this other jazz is great and wonderful. I know a safety record in the United States has been real good. Maybe in the whole world's been good. But sometime, somewhere, and I think it's going to happen with a lot more than just aviation, these computers, you don't know what's going to happen. You need some way to go back to flying like you used to be in a 727 or a DC-7 or a DC-8 or a 1011. You had one button you could mash, and you were flying there.
I do want to just add, I should have said this in the beginning, it's very important to understand that these pilots were in manual flight. They were not in autopilot. This system kicks in only in manual flight. Just throwing that out there.
Well, that's true, but they couldn't turn off what was going bad. Something was going bad, and they couldn't turn it off. Didn't know how. Didn't even know what was going bad.
Yeah.
I'm old school, Christine. Oh, Carlene, I'm sorry.
Okay, let's go up to out to Oregon. Jeff, what's your thoughts about this? Jeff Lewis.
Well, you guys have my head swimming already with all the great points you bring up. But I will say that the MAX 8, it's a very significant thing what is going on, this trend towards automation, and quite frankly, it's exactly the same trend we see going on in the air traffic control end of things with next gen. But in this case, where you have automation that's being imposed with the failure by Boeing to ensure that the pilots are aware of that system, it puts them in a program where they're needing to save the flight and unaware of what they're fighting against. There's also, though, an evolution with the MAX 8 that was brought forth the last couple days by Clive Irving's article that was shared amongst us at Aviation Week and Space Technology, where he gets into the evolution of the aircraft to put larger engines on it and configure them in a way that it looks like the 737. We may eventually find out the 737 was its design, was evolved with a tighter and tighter safety envelope for which they needed to initiate creation or implement a system such as the MCAS. Why they didn't disclose that, fully incorporate that into their training regimen that would go out to, especially to newer, younger airlines like out in Indonesia, is quite a puzzle and certainly puts Boeing in a position of liability for an accident such as this. We're also, the other thing I wanted to say, and Christine touched on it very well right at the front end, is how extremely valuable it is that we have websites such as FlightAware and FlightRadar24 that we still have today and hopefully always will have a level of transparency that enables the flight data to get out there where people can see what's going on, because lacking that, activists or people who are, you know, hobbyists or professional writers who study these things don't have the tools they need to be able to ensure that the investigative process goes forward in a way that will really touch on the problems and address them rather than figure out some clever way to hide them.
Well, I've got to say amen to that. This is Christine again, because as someone who often writes about air accidents in the early stages, I do get a lot of hate mail. It's a bit strong, but I do get criticized quite a bit by people who say I shouldn't, and I'm putting using air quotes right now, speculate. And, you know, I've written, in fact, I just, in relation to Lion Air, I wrote a blog post on my blog, Flying Lessons, in which I said, speculation, in my mind, if it's informed speculation and based on available facts, is not necessarily a bad thing. I talk in my book, The Crash Detectives, I talk about George Jenn's book, in which he, as a guy sitting in his den in Long Island, basically came up with more information and more valid information about the loss of Eastern Airlines flight. It was 801, right? Do I have that right, George?
No, 980.
Not 980, sorry. He came up with more and better information than that accident than anything the official investigators came up with. So all of those, you know, the critics who say, oh, Christine, you shouldn't do that, let the investigators do their work, I'm not stopping them from doing their work. But no one should take, you know, should just say, oh, yes, they'll do it. Let's just sit here for 3 years and wait for them to tell us what happened. Not when information is available virtually everywhere now, everywhere. Good, solid information. There are no more secrets. And if you're educated enough and experienced enough to be able to see these clues, there is no reason why we should not be having conversations, just like the conversation we're having tonight.
George Jenn?
Yeah, I think that both Christine and Jeff have touched on some really good points about this particular crash, because well, my first question would be, where was the FAA during all of this? You know, they're supposed to be the overseers of flight safety, and I find it very difficult to believe that if Boeing was concerned about the stall characteristics of the new 737 MAX because of the installation of the larger engines, that they wouldn't inform the FAA about it, or the FAA would not, their experts wouldn't be questioning them about what possible, problems or conflicts there might be as a result. So that would be my first question. I mean, look, I certainly believe that if there's any liability here, it goes to the manufacturer, and I think that that's probably already shown by the fact that there's been, I would presume, a product liability lawsuit that's been filed here in the United States. But, you know, it's not a single corporate or a single person job to ensure the safety, and the FAA is there to look over the manufacturer's shoulders to make certain that there's nothing on board the aircraft that could cause something like this. And so that would be my first question, is where was the FAA? But having flown, I flew the 737, 200, 300, and 400, and it as the picture shows of the new MAX, it has a trim wheel that when you trim the aircraft, it turns, and of course you have to set the trim before you take off depending upon the fuel load and the load on the aircraft, et cetera. But it, the first thing I wondered about, and Jim touched upon this, or maybe it was you, Neil, if you have a runaway trim, that the wheel would turn. But I'm just wondering if this program didn't do something so that the trim wheel wasn't affected at all, because the pilots obviously had no clue what the problem was. And if there was a runaway trim wheel, I think they would have said, oh, my goodness, something wrong with the trim, and done whatever they had to do to prevent that from happening. And so that was one of the questions that I had, along with the fact that there was a previous, I believe there were two, in the previous day, there were two write-ups on this aircraft, maintenance write-ups, about the angle of attack indicator or something like that. I'd just like to ask someone, maybe Christine, do you know if anybody has ever ascertained what those write-ups were?
No, I don't. I don't know enough about that. I will say, though, that I spoke to a 737 MAX captain who told me, and you guys probably know this more than I, that the angle of attack indicator is oftentimes damaged on the ground by the jetway, by the installation of the jetway, when the jetway is not, you know, handled properly, that it can be damaged. I didn't realize it was so susceptible to ground handling damage, and that it can appear to be, in this captain's words, it can appear to be just fine, but not necessarily. That might not necessarily be the case. In this case, I don't think it was a ground handling issue because it was the previous pilot who reported the problem on it, and I think they'd taken it and the news reports say that they had taken that the maintenance had taken it and worked on it and then reinstalled the angle of attack or replaced. I don't know which.
Well, you know, it would just seem to me, as you pointed out, that rather than openness and direct communications, that we're starting to see some problems here that say that, well, maybe somebody doesn't like something that was done that may have been the cause of this, and there's a total lack of information that's been forthcoming. Granted, I don't remember who it was who pointed it out, but the cockpit voice recorder, which hasn't been recovered yet, will certainly tell a lot. But, I don't know, maybe I would presume it hasn't been recorded. Recovered. Let me put it that way, okay? But there's just too many things already here that point that people are trying to point the finger away from different things, like the airline's trying to point the finger away from them. The FAA has been totally quiet here. The manufacturer has scheduled different things that have been then taken off the table. So, I mean, it just kind of smells a little bit to me.
You know, George, what I was thinking about in terms of Boeing and the FAA, and it kind of reminds me of the section in my book when I talk about the Dreamliner batteries, in which, you know, mm-hmm. the FAA first says there can be no fire, there can be no smoke, there can be no flammability issues on the Dreamliner, and by the time the 787 battery is certified for use, they're okay. Well, okay, fine. You know, we'll allow it to go up in a box. So long as the battery's in a box, it's okay if we have a fire. I kind of get the impression that on some of these issues, this technological issues, there is such a shortage of people with technological knowledge that they go to the highest bidder, and that is not going to be the FAA. And, you know, when I write about this, I call it the bamboozle effect, because you're Boeing, you're going to pay top dollar, ostensibly, you're going to pay top dollar to the technology people because you need them. But when the FAA and the NTSB were looking into the Dreamliner battery after the two batteries, had their issues and the airplane was grounded, and I have this in my book, the woman in charge of this at the NTSB said to me, we couldn't even get batteries or battery experts because Boeing had them all. So when the accident happened, Boeing went out and scooped up everybody, you know, that had any knowledge in this subject, and now the NTSB guys, who are, you know, basically like pin kickers, have to understand very complex electromagnetic chemistry and battery chemistry. You know, where are they going to get that expertise? I think this point that you make is a real live issue. Where do they get this expertise?
Yes, I agree with that completely.
Talking about computer.
Hey guys, can I jump into the conversation for a minute?
Please.
I'm gonna go way back to, first off, Christine, I agree with you wholeheartedly that these, while albeit speculation, these kind of conversations are going to help and they're going to save lives, because right now we're going to go on the air and tell any pilot flying an airplane, if your stabilizer runs away, head out and go to the cutoff switches. if your autopilot's not working, disengage it, fly your airplane. You know, and back to the 727, yeah, there wasn't a break in there. You could go the opposite direction, would break it. And then what would happen is you'd go to the cutoff switches for the hydraulics. And the 737 has cutoff switches, and I believe the new models now, when you cut them off, you're cutting electricity. And that's really the primary difference between old school and new gen, is that everything is wired, and it's electronic. So we can disengage. Nothing short of pulling the power, pushing your button on your computer to shut it off. They have the ability. The question is, why didn't they do that? And, you know, George, I'm gonna have a tendency to agree with you that we just assume they didn't get those the voice recorder. But I highly suspect that we probably heard, oh, my gosh, trim on that voice recorder, is what I'm going to guess, and it's only in my opinion and the reason we're not hearing it. And then we have to take this accident and correlate it with Air France 447. Those pilots had every bit of technology. They knew everything that airplane was going to do because it was in the manual, and they still didn't do it. And why not? Well, and so is it just because it's in the manual or not, will they remember and be able to react accordingly would be a good question. And not unlike 447, you know, this airline knew it was a problem, and they allowed it to fly. 447, there have been numerous incidents with the pitot tube, had the same problem. It just didn't manifest in the same accident. And we wait until we have accidents before we create change. And this one, if this accident hadn't gone on, they probably would have had a number of incidents.
Well, but the Air France accident was caused by what Jim raised before, and that was the fact that there was the basics were sorely missing from both of the pilots that were in the cockpit at that time. I mean, you know.
Well, not the basics were missing from these pilots, too, because they were in VFR conditions. They could see, and they knew what the aircraft was doing. They could have disengaged the power. On the A330, they were in IFR conditions. With all the electronics gone, they couldn't identify, you know, if you notice they bank left, bank right, they left, they couldn't identify a level. They could have just the interesting thing is they could have taken their hands off that automated aircraft and the airplane would have stabilized, flown them out of it without doing anything. They induced it. In this case, automation was inducing the crash and they needed to take action and interject to stop it. Mm-hmm. And so they were both automation related incidents for different reasons. One needed, don't do anything. One needed, react and do something about it and stop it from going that direction.
Right, but I think you missed one point there, Carlene, and that's that they had no way of knowing about this because no one ever told the airline, so they couldn't be trained for it. Granted, it might go back again to what Jim said, you know, the basics. If the plane keeps, I mean, I'm sure you read that also where even if they pulled back on the control column and leveled the plane off, well, I think it was 10 seconds later, the computer would pitch it over again. So, you know, the basics are what was missing there, and how do you correct that? That's the problem.
Well, if in their
minds
these pilots believe they are in manual flight, they are already, Carlene, at the point where they believe they are flying the airplane. And then the airplane noses over. That, I'm no pilot, but if I think I'm flying the airplane and I cannot get the nose up, I'm going to think there's some mechanical problem. If they're not thinking that, they're not thinking automation. They know they're in a manual flight.
Well, manual flight or not, if a stabilizer is running away, George, on the 727, if that stabilizer ran away, what would you do?
Well, you'd stop it, but you knew that was happening
there.
Because the trim wheel was moving. That's why one of the questions that I raised here was when this program, this MCAS, is activated, I doubt very much if the trim wheel even turned. I think that the program just took over.
Well, even without a trim wheel turning, there's an indication about the stabilizer, as you mentioned, that you have to set it for takeoff. Well, you can see on that if it's which direction it's going. So that will be
maybe
an indication of the trim's running away.
Well, but that's one of the questions that an investigation here has to answer, whether or not there was an indication of a runaway stabilizer or not. There may not have been. If it was a silently activated computer program that simply pushed the elevator trim all the way to the down position, they would have no way of knowing that.
What in your mind would be a cause of a runaway elevator trim in manual flight? What does that say to you? What's your initial thought about what that must be?
Well, see, that's a misnomer with the manual flight and automation. Because as I was conducting my research, when the professors asked me, well, because I thought it was a level of understanding would impact pilots' willingness to manually fly. And his perception was, no, manual flight, if they don't understand electronics, they are more apt to use manual flight. And that's just the opposite. And I've statistically proven it's the opposite. And the reason is that even with the autopilot disengaged, there are electric components operating these aircraft. You're not, when you're manually flying, you're not disengaging the electrics from the aircraft. And that's
okay,
a basic
that question,
core knowledge.
What would cross your mind as a pilot, what would cross your mind if you're flying the airplane, you believe you're in control of the aircraft, and it noses over? What would you think?
If it was doing that, if it nosed over, I would know instantly it was stabilizing. That would be the first thing I would do. Cut it off. And if I couldn't pull that airplane back, I would take off everything to give me the control of that aircraft pitch moment.
And if you pulled back and you could not get the aircraft and you found resistance as they would have, and then when you were pulling back and then it went down again against your physical exertion to pull the airplane nose up, what would you think then?
Wouldn't happen because what I said is the first thing, pull back, and if there's pressure on it, you relieve the pressure by cutting off the stabilizer. Get rid of the stabilizer. It's like,
right,
now you have control of the aircraft. Manual flight
Chuck.
Doesn't...
Isn't the ultimate question is, why can't they pull those circuit breakers to the motors? I guarantee
They could have, but the quick and easy way is cut the stabilizer, because basically those stabilizers, I believe, are cutting the power to it. So it's similar to pulling a circuit breaker. It'd be easier, quicker access for them. Same thing.
Yeah.
But like you said, if you flip the switches and the computer is still running the airplane, you haven't accomplished anything.
Well, if you flip the switches, it's not going to be running the stabilizer because it will cut the power to the stabilizer.
Well, I don't believe it would cut the power to the stabilizer. It would cut the power to the trim motors. To the trim motors, that's correct.
Exactly. Thank you. And here's the thing with the and once again, each of these new electronic aircraft have different power sources for different components, and not reading that manual on that aircraft, I don't know. Okay, but when the difference is from what old school, when we used to do that, we cut the hydraulics off. So today we cut the electricity off to something. So, but once again, none of us have read that manual, so we don't know, and how that system works. But as a pilot, and you guys, the reason I'm really heightened to this is because this is what my research is about. I investigated safety culture, training, understanding, and added aviation passion in there, and I wanted to look at the impact to manual flight and performance. And what I learned in this is statistically that our training programs worldwide, and I looked at airline, corporate, charter, fractional, is negatively impacting how we're flying our airplanes. It's negative. Our training programs are negatively impacting how we fly our airplanes. Now, what does that mean? Why is that? You know, we're going to need further investigation, but for what it appears, our pilots, the more training they have, the less they're willing to do this. And the less they're willing to do it, the less ability they have.
I want to ask Christine, in your research so far, have you heard of any airlines giving scenarios now in the simulators about what happened here and seeing how the pilots reacted to that?
I have not, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if they were doing it. You know, one of the things that struck me as interesting, and Carlene, I'd love to hear what you think about this, transition from the 737 next gen to the 737 MAX can be anything from no transition at all well, which is what an American 737 MAX captain told me, there was no transition training, to watching some videotapes at Southwest. And so in the New York Times story about this, they talk about, you know, in a fairly disparaging way, talk about, you know, these pilots at Lion Air didn't get, you know, they watched the video and their transition, and isn't that terrible? But the fact of the matter is, that's the American standard. That's apparently the way people are transitioning to on the 737 to the MAX. So, you know, it does sound to me like they're doing a lot of training even from one model to the other, and I guess that's the sales pitch for the MAX, is that, you know, it's the same cockpit, but these are some fairly substantially different handling characteristics on the MAX than on the next gen. What do you think of that, you know, since you are looking into training?
Well, that statement just proves, in essence, what this data shows. It identified that training is impacting how we're flying our aircraft. And the concept from old school to new school, you know, years ago, pilots had to draw the electrical system, and then they had to draw their molecule of air and how they would get through the engine. And that's no longer the case today. And the reason being, because it's automation, pilots don't need to know. It'll just do it itself. My firm contention is that is not a good stance. The more automated the aircraft is, in my opinion, the more we need to know. And Boeing needs to put everything back in their manuals. And operators need to train pilots on everything, so at least we have some kind of core knowledge to fall back on. And granted, if these guys had heard this, it could be a problem. Maybe they would have been more proactive to think, oh, that's some they might not have remembered what it was specifically or how to deal with it, but it may have reacted to, you know, cut the stabilizer. We don't know.
But I
firmly believe more training.
Yeah, Carlene, you hit on something that I remember a long time ago. My FAA oral was on the Electra, draw the fuel systems with the cross-feed transfers. And that was the entire oral. I had to put it on a piece of paper.
How do you remember that on the digitized aircraft? How do you achieve that on an airplane that is essentially, you know, a network
electrical
of computerized systems?
Yeah. And
that's
the streamliners.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I got to go to a mechanic school when they get a new airplane. We had to know where all the valves and all the things were.
Yeah.
Automation
is
not the answer to everything.
Yeah.
Well, you got that right.
Well,
Neil, do you remember you could cross-feed about three different ways on the Electra, and that's not as complicated as it got.
That's right.
Again, I know I'm old school, old man, sitting down here in the woods listening to rain. This was these ladies' talk. I'm astounded. They'd really done their homework. Of course, Carlene is a pilot for some airline. I understand we don't know exactly what airline it is now. Is that right, Carlene?
I'm actually a researcher right now. Danny Riddle.
So you're a researcher.
Well,
aviation researcher, good.
Pretty soon you're going to have to call her doctor. Just watch out.
Okay. We've come a long way from stick and rudder and needle ball airspeed, haven't we?
Yeah. You know, Neil, you and I both remember those old captains that we flew with back when we were new in the 60s, and they were complaining about how we had it easy with VORs and ILS. They used to have to make radio range approaches, and we marveled at them, and how did they do it and everything. And now you and I, well, I'm not sure what we are.
Every one of you people have an iPod or something of that sort, or one of your iPhones or something, and it has more technology in it today than it did 50 years ago.
I know.
Yeah. They say that a wristwatch I had a few years ago had more power than the lander on the moon with those guys back in, when was it, 69?
Something like that.
My wristwatch had more power.
It is amazing. And, you know, when I was writing the Crash Detectives, I interviewed the pilot of the of the I think his name was Pearson. No, not Pearson. Anyway, I interviewed the pilot of the Glimley glider. Do you remember that? The 767 that put down in the
Up in Canada.
In Canada, right. His name is flown out of my head. Bob was his first name. And he told me he was so funny because he talked about, you know, this whole error in that they put the fuel in and they did the calculation, you know, from imperial gallons to gallons or liters or whatever. But the point was, he said, I had no idea when I two weeks of transition training, talking about transition training, two weeks of transition training from the airplane he was on before to the 767, and he said, but what did I know about computers? I knew how to use an ATM. That's how he saw this airplane. It would have the complexity of an ATM. That's how little he understood about that airplane. And, you know, a little about, you know, about how computers are sort of moving in the aviation airspace. I find that kind of astonishing because he didn't know, you know, and he's the first one to admit it, the technology that would be, you know, coming into play as he flew the thing. And that was essentially their problem, that they didn't realize that the fuel gauge was going to be counting up what they entered, not necessarily gallons in the tank, which is how they wound up, you know, running out of fuel halfway across Canada.
He was pretty good at flying the glider, though.
Yes, he was, and that's the thing. That's why he made such a great example. Because he was both a great pilot and confounded by the new kind of airplane pilot. He was both, which I think is where we are today.
Right, but what's going to happen when the old-timers are all gone? And that's going to happen pretty shortly when the only pilots that are in the cockpit are the ones that grew up with all this technology and have come to rely upon it without the basics. That's frightening.
I feel differently, George. I feel like we're in a transition period in which there's going to be maybe a generation of accidents that are precisely like Lion Air and Air France. And we're going to come out of that with a whole new breed of pilots who understand the technology much better than they understand the flying, and that's going to be okay. I do.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that, but we'll have to pay the price to get there.
Yes, that is correct. That is correct.
Yeah.
It ain't going to be pretty.
There's a young man in my airport. Go ahead.
Jim?
Hello.
Jim?
Yeah, there's a young man at my airport flying for an airline now. And I won't identify the airline or the airplane, but he said that, and he just checked out his captain, that they are trained to engage the autopilot shortly after takeoff, and they disengage it shortly after landing.
Yep, 370.
Yeah, what are they going to do when they got to fly the airplane on one engine and a lightning storm and everything below minimum?
Well, through my research, I found two different numbers on that. One said average pilot flies 3 minutes, and another stated 7 minutes for the entire flight.
My goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
What about the Asian plane last year that crashed because the co-pilot never landed the airplane? It was always autopilot.
Oh, you mean Asiana 214 in San
Francisco?
Yeah.
What about the two guys with a jumpsuit rider qualified, flying in at San Francisco with no wind, clear day, and managed to hit a dike? Now, that's a whole different ball game. I know they were hand-flying the airplane, I guess. Maybe they should have been using all the pilot. I don't know.
There's a problem because while they were hand-flying it, they didn't realize what level of automation they were in, and they didn't understand their automation. And what their craft would do or would not do. And that was a very contributing factor of that accident.
You have a scenario like that in your book, Carlene, I think.
Yeah.
I did. I have lots of scenarios of real life in my novels.
I have a friend that after he turned 60, he became a simulator instructor over there in Korea, and he said that the captain was never to be questioned. It was very, very obvious, you know, in the training, that the captain was never to be questioned. I mean, it was just unheard of. Look what happened.
Not anymore.
Yeah, they probably changed that little attitude.
I have
another. They got that cockpit. What is it, Neil? cockpit management where you can actually tell the captain
CRM.
That he's wrong?
CRM.
Yeah, CRM. Yeah. Cockpit.
Lord knows I had a co-pilot tell me I was wrong, and I was happy about it.
Well, I have another question here. I don't think that we've discussed it all, and that is, does anybody have any opinions out there about whether there are even additional programs on this or other aircraft that the pilots are unaware of? And if so, what is the obligation on the part of Boeing or Airbus and the FAA to find out those answers?
That's a good question.
Well, Boeing and Airbus would probably take advantage of that because they're the ones that's going to get sued.
Well, you guys remember Colgan Air? I would go back and look at that again because Colgan Air was what resulted from that was thick pressure training. They did the same thing. They didn't identify.
Yeah.
They knew the system was on their aircraft, and they responded inaccurately to it. So the system was there. They knew it. They were supposedly trained for it. They still didn't do it right.
No, he did not do it right, and he got a co-pilot for a software that came in, was known to be feeling probably sick and everything, and he was sort of under-experienced himself. But again, you know, he just stalled it all the way to ground, just like Air France did.
Hello.
To the water, though.
So just remember, they're building automobiles with the same stuff in them.
I want to see if we can get another voice in here. Hello?
Well, I was listening, and I agree pretty much with everything that everybody else is saying. This is Mike here from New York, I see that they have the markings on those stabilizer trim wheels. So if that thing would be, they put them on there for a reason to see if it's moving. And I guess they probably, I can't tell by the picture, and I have never been in the cockpit of a MAX, of course, whether it has those kneecap removing the knobs that flip out for the manual trim.
Oh God!
We've all forgotten about the kneecap remover because
removers were long gone.
What was that?
They don't have those anymore. I believe the kneecap removers have been long gone.
Yeah, I don't know. I flew a 200-7.3 as a co-pilot, and they had kind of the same thing as the 7.2. But I'm just looking at a picture here, and I don't know if they have a stabilizer cutout knob like they used to have on a 727 or not. But this MAX has got still got control wheels in it, and I think probably the system is the precursor to putting a side stick in this airplane, where you don't have any, below those two yokes, you got a big belt crank down there that runs the cables. So it's got to be still run by cables, and whatever these automated system on the MCAS system that they have, it's got to be something that overrides, takes over through that angle of attack sensor that makes the stabilizer uncontrollable if you're trying to fly it manually. But I don't, of course, what we've all discussed on this thing, everything that everybody said, it kind of makes sense. But I kind of think that the interjection of finally in Boeing moving those control yokes out of the cockpit like all the other airplanes, this may be a precursor to it. So that's kind of all I really had to add to it, but agree with everybody else.
They've got to recover that voice recorder.
Which is why it probably will not be found.
I don't know why they can't find it, but it's only in, 5,000 feet of water?
No, it's not that deep.
No, 3,000. Oh, yeah. Like 3,000?
No, I don't think it's – I think it's in the hundreds of feet, but that's why I raised the issue before, the question – have they in fact recovered it? And nobody knows. You know, I mean, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but stranger things have happened. That's for sure.
You might be right, George.
Owen's got a big bank.
I remember that there was I wrote about it. Mark Rosenker was maybe the acting chairman or the chairman of the safety board at the time. There was an accident in Indonesia. And this was the second time I'd heard this played out. The first time was with Atomair, which was 2004, 2005, something like that. And the Indonesians would not spend the money to get the black boxes up. They were located, but they wouldn't spend the money to get them up. Then Rosenkur was involved and in, was around when there was another accident in Indonesia, and the Indonesians basically told him, unless the Americans pay, we're not getting it. And I remember he was very, very upset about it. I did a blog post about it back, and I'm just Googling it now. It was about 2014. They said to him, you want to bring, he said, it was a, yeah, 2000, it was an Atomair. And Rosenkur was the chairman at the time, and he said, he called up the Indonesians, and he said, so what's going on here? Where, you know, where are we going to get those boxes? And they said, listen, if you want the boxes, it's going to cost $2 million. Send us the money.
Oh.
Rosenkur said, that is not the way it's going to happen.
$2 million?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I never heard that one.
Yeah, it's in, yeah. I just pulled it up while I was talking to you. It was Asia Air Flight 8501. So there was two accidents, and in both of these accidents, the Indonesians were loath to spend the money to pull up the boxes. That, at the end of the day, it was about money. And what's troubling about that? I mean, it's troubling on a number of levels, but what's, you know, most interesting about this, and I think we fail to appreciate this as much in the United States, but the hugest growth in aviation right now is happening in countries with long overwater flights. The countries in the Arab world, Emirates, Qatar, Etihad, then Vietnam Airlines, the low-cost carriers in Indonesia, in India, these airlines are all traveling, growing like tremendously because of the benefit, the increasing economies in those countries and more people traveling. China, sorry, should have mentioned China. But the flights are not just more flights; they are more long haul over water flights. So it's a higher level of risk, especially. I mean, you look at Malaysia 370. Higher level of risk, especially because, and I did write about this in my book, Malaysia knew a year before Malaysia 370 went missing that it was not tracking its airliners as often as it was required to do by its own civil aviation authority. So, you know, these developing countries have to be as conscientious about air safety as the developed world is, and sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're going to see these accidents happening.
Yeah, well, that's another issue, though, completely, Christine, and that is the extended overwater operations with twin-engine airplanes. You know, if you think about it, we went from four to three and now to two, and combine that with maintenance that might be less than desirable, and it's just a disaster waiting to happen.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, it is. And if you look at the most recent accidents we've had, you'll see that the locus has been Indonesia, Malaysia, that part of the world. They're flying over water all the time.
Yep.
Wow, what a discussion we've had. This is one fantastic roundtable. I think this is the best we've ever had, even with the Emory Riddles Dean of Aviation there from Daytona Beach. We'll have to do this again.
Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm not.
Carlene, go ahead.
Yeah, we have the absolutely most awesome dean who is a safety management system expert. He is wonderful. So,
is he the one that is in Daytona Beach or out in Arizona?
He's down in Daytona Beach.
Oh.
And he is the SMS guru. And what we were talking about, CRM, what SMS is, basically crew resource management for the organization. No longer can the organization say, we are God, you do what we say. And it's supposed to enable all the employees who are the people out there working to be able to come forward in a retaliation-free environment and create suggestions and make comments and stuff. So probably not unlike early CRM. There are a lot of growing pains with this one, but we're going to get there. And, yeah, the dean he's written numerous books on SMS, fabulous books, if you ever want to read them and see what that's all about.
Very good. Okay. We have a great show coming up next Monday, and it's going to be Captain Charles J. White with the crash of his Constellation up in Ridgeville, Connecticut in 1965. And it's going to be an interesting show. And here they landed in a field. Actually, it was Hunt's Mountain that they landed on, a little hill, forested. And most of the people, just four of them that died in that accident. And the captain was one of them.
That's what our guest chose, Mr. Dick Ahrens, Neil.
Right, right. So that's going to be a very interesting show, and that was a crash caused by a mid-air collision of TWA Air 707 and Eastern Constellation shuttle flight. So tune in for that show. It's going to be interesting. Thanks so much to all of our guest hosts tonight. I appreciate it. And wow, a very, very good discussion. I appreciate it. Christine, thanks so much for being with us. Carlene, it's always good to have you with us. And Jeff, way out there in Oregon, it's been a good discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Neil, you want to make a couple of announcements?
Yes, please do.
The Old Time Radio Show, Thursday, November 29th, will have Miles Davis, the jazz trumpeteer. And as Neil said, episode 393, December 3rd, will be our guest host, Mr. Dick Ahrens, followed by the December 6th from the Eastern Files. We also have episode 394 on December 10th that's going to have cockpit crew preferences. And that's another hot topic out there. Then we follow with the final old-time radio show on December 13th to have Winston Larson Marcellus. And we'll probably have Christmas music then for everyone. Don't forget, too, that we want to thank this is a letter from Rosalind Rush thanking Dorothy, Don, and Neil, and crew for all you do in keeping our beloved airline in our hearts and to have a forum to express our thoughts and hear from others. As you know, Rosalind worked for Eastern for over 30 years, and it was her life. Now she lives near the FAA towers on top of Mount Oglethorpe and watches the planes turn off their lights at night as they take off from Hartsville and reach a 10,000 feet. Again, thanks for all you do. Happy holidays and best, Rosalind Rush. And also I want to mention that Neil has that Auburn University Educational Experience Scholarship. We have that up on the website now, and it is under Home, under Scholarships, for everybody to see the letters that have come from Auburn University, and announcing the two winners of those scholarships. So be sure to check our website out for that. Again, we appreciate all going to the website and viewing all of the information we have there. It's a great deal of information, but it's a lot to keep the memories of Eastern and our legacy going. So please utilize the website. We'd appreciate it. Thanks, and back to you, Neil.
Well, Carlene and Christine, you both have a blog. You both have a Facebook, or is it websites that you can
both.
Give? And you can
both website mostly.
Subscribe to them.
We're modern girls. We have it all.
Tell us how to get there, modern girls. Tell us how to get to your website.
We even have the Twitter.
Yeah, we tweet.
Well,
I have a Facebook group called Flying Lessons. Flying Lessons. I have a blog called Flying Lessons. I'm Christine Negroni. I'm found at any of those places. So please.
I just signed up for it just last week, Christine.
It's excellent. There's excellent information on there, Neil.
Yeah.
Yes,
and Carlene, you've got one too.
I do. CarleenePettit.com, or if you type in Flight to Success, you'll find it also.
Very good.
And that's a great blog too, Colleen.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hello.
Yes, Jim Holder.
Yes, would you tell, or I can tell the listeners that I'm still trying to get rid of the last two issues of Repartee, the 2017 and 2018. If any of the hosts do not get it already, they'll send you a message and let me know the address. I'd be glad to send out these magazines and make some space in my office for something else.
Oh, good. Christine, now's your chance to get one. Carleen, get one.
Repartee magazine.
Great.
And the 18 issue, has Neil Holland being inducted into the FRIPA Hall of Fame, which was done last September. And he made a great speech afterwards. So we didn't think he'd say much at all, but he said he wasn't going to say much at all, but he talked almost 10 minutes.
Oh, like come it. On.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, great show tonight, folks. Thanks so much, especially Sunday night.
Thank you all.
I hope you all had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and the holidays coming up is going to be the best for you. My wife has a broken arm, so I'm a caregiver now and helping her out, and it's an arm that she uses, and she can't drive, and she can't do a lot of other things. And and now she's learning how important I am.
She's got a broken arm. How do you look?
We can well understand what it's like not having your arms for sure when you hurt them.
Yeah. Well.
Yeah, but she can use the other hand for the whip, right, Neil?
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to get the airplane landed, and I'm going to go home and fix something for dinner for my wife. I've been cooking here lately and doing a lot of things I've never done before. So here we go. Let's land.
Put that Eastern apron on.
You're getting educated with what we do every day.
Purdue. Here we go. Chuck, your time.
Great landing, Captain, as usual. Thank all of our guests tonight. You have given us so much to talk about. Be sure to tune in again next Monday, November the 29th, when America's favorite way to fly returns with another flight of adventure. Well, that's our show for tonight, folks. With this, we take a line from the stories of Lake Wobegon, where all the Eastern women are unequal. All the Eastern flight attendants are above airline standards, and all the men are good looking, and all the Eastern children and Eastern grandchildren are way above average. Until then, we say good night, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern family. We love you, Eastern.
Good
great
night,
show, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much.
Was excellent. Thank you.